these are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And I think it'd be interesting to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient. Ends and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today I'm going to talk with Anthony Appiah, one of the leading philosophers and thinkers on the meaning of identity and identity politics. But we're going to start here.
I want to show them my room.
Your room.
Yeah, we definitely want to see that. Aw, that's a nice family photo.
I wasn't in it.
We're in a small city in New England, in an apartment building with vinyl siding on a busy street, in the bedroom of a teenager named Dayanara, who's giving staff writer Sarah Stillman a tour.
Oh, I like the lighting. Mood lighting. It smells nice, too.
I have a lot of lights, because it's very dark. This was sixth grade band. I used to be in band.
Okay, what instrument did you play?
Piccolo and flute.
Oh, cool.
Stillman, along with reporter Micah Hauser, has been talking with Dayanara and her family for almost a year. They're trying to understand what this family is going through, something that's both extraordinary and at the same time very common. And it's likely to get more common every day of the Trump administration. Here's Micah Hauser and Sarah Stillman.
Dayanara is 14 years old, and she's a little quiet and shy at first, but she quickly warms up and is eager to tell us about her room.
She's got long, dark hair, and when we met her, she was wearing a hoodie and sort of fashionably ripped blue jeans.
Holy crap, that pink bear is huge. What is that from?
My dad got me this for Valentine's Day.
It's like literally as big, it's bigger than you.
We went to see them for the first time on a cold day in March. And this is New England, so it was bitterly cold, and it felt like the depths of winter.
And did you say, do you have any writings that you did for your mom or anything that...
They're in the closet, but my closet has a lot of ads in it.
Okay, all right.
It's like a lot. Ta-da.
Ooh, I like that purple dress.
Yeah, this is... I got this for free from a field trip.
Really? Gorgeous.
Dayanara is the only girl, so she has her own bedroom. Her two older brothers, Andy and Arnold Jr., share a room. Their dad is working constantly as a janitor, so they don't see that much of him these days.
I think I found it.
Yay!
Is this stuck under all this
bag?
Okay.
That's your little shoebox.
Yep. This is some of the stuff that I was gonna send her, but this is the note that she sent me.
Oh, that's nice. So your mom sent you these letters from there?
Yeah.
Hola, mi princesa. It's from Mom. How are you, my beautiful child? And can I see the other letter?
These are some of the notes that my dad didn't get to send because she was deported.
I see. So your dad wrote these notes hoping to send them to her while she was in detention, but then instead she was deported. I see. That's tough. Because were you hoping when your mom was in detention that she would get to stay here?
Yeah.
Or what were you thinking at that time?
I thought she would get out. Because, like, everyone was hoping she wouldn't talking positive about it.
I see. So you were feeling pretty hopeful.
Yeah.
And how did you find out that that wouldn't be the case, that she was going to be deported?
My dad told me.
Your dad, yeah.
And I called Andy.
Yeah. And what did you say to Andy?
I was like, didn't you know that mom's getting deported? And he's like, no, wait, what?
Dayanara's mom, Adalia, was deported in 2017, and since then she's been living in Santa Rita, Honduras.
Dayanara Mayora, she sings. She's beautiful voice.
I know, we want to hear. Queremos oírlo.
No.
No podemos. We want to hear her sing.
You want to hear my mom sing?
Maybe your mom can start and then you can sing.
Ma, ellos dijeron que tú puedes cantar, no Daya.
Sing. Stop being sing.
Ma, quieren que cantes.
Ellos quieren que Daya cante.
No, quieren que tú cantas.
Daya.
Madre. Canta.
Dayanara, ¿dónde estás? Aquí con mamá. Andy, Andy, papi. Arnold, vamos todos con mamá. Oh, my God. Es duro para mí, pues. Cantar estas canciones porque se las canto a ellos por teléfono y es fuerte. Sí.
She made that song for us. It's like Daya, Daya, come to ma, and then like something about my dad going to us too, and then that, it's like a song that she made for us like when we were little kids to like t- too close to, like, so we could be happy. And then, like, every time she'd sing, we'd get happy when she sung the song. And then she said it was hard for her because she had to sing it over the phone instead of in person to us.
That's Andy, the middle child. He's 16 years old. And he and Dayanara are U.S. citizens. And their older brother, Arnold Jr., has DACA status because he was a baby when his mother and father came to the U.S. from Honduras. And how would you describe your mom's personality?
She's crazy.
Like, what kind of crazy?
Andy used to have a hoverboard, and she would ride it and scream cherry.
Like, she's,
cherry? Why cherry?
I don't know. That was her favorite thing, too. She would, like, go down this hallway, like, the fastest the hoverboard can go. She would, like that, and then she would be like, cherry, and, like, spin, and, like...
The movie Big Mama Cherry.
Oh, it's from the movie Big Mama? Yeah, okay, yeah. So at least she had a rationale.
Yeah, and then, like, I taught her how to use the hoverboard, and then, one time she fell on her back. The first time she learned, she fell on her back, but she got back up. She's like, I'm doing it again. Go back on the hoverboard, and then, like, she got a hold of it, and she actually started taking it to work, and she would ride around in the hallways at work, like zoom what? Through the hallways.
So that she would do her job on the hoverboard?
Yeah, basically.
That's awesome. She must have been popular.
Yeah, and then she was happy, like, oh, I have a hoverboard. She actually wanted me to send her the hoverboard. But
in Honduras?
Yeah. And I was like, are you crazy? He'll kill you for that.
No. So Adalia worked in a hotel doing housekeeping, and then later she was on the kitchen staff there. She and her husband had been in the U.S. for 2 decades by that point. But people like Adalia only became a deportation priority after Trump was elected. In late February of 2017, she got pulled over on her way to work early one morning.
So I think it was like 4:30, and I got a call, and I was like, oh, your mom got arrested. But they didn't tell me the police station.
Can you walk us through what happened? Like,
so
what
I guess
understand?
She was on the light to take a right. If we go to the hotel... I'll show you where she was, and they pulled out the back, and like they like surrounded her car, like they like trapped her.
And who's the they?
The police. So they took her to the police station first, and then they processed her. She only had $25 cash on her, and they didn't. She's like, I'll give you my credit card. I'll do anything. I'll give you the pin so you could go take it out if you want.
What he's talking about there is bail.
And then they said no, and then like. 10 minutes after I got that call, they gave her to immigration.
So over the last year, we've been reporting on immigration enforcement and specifically on mothers who've been deported under Trump. So Adalia became for us a way to understand what happens if you're sent back to Honduras without your kids. How do you take care of them? How do you mother them by way of a computer screen or by way of a phone? Because Adalia was a super, super involved mom, and it's very clear that she wants to stay involved from Honduras. It's just a matter of exploring, even methodologically, how do you mother from afar?
Ay, mi chalelo, ¿y por qué me pone ese chalelo de mami, hombre?
Oh my God, mom.
Esa cosa, ¿y por qué me pone en pausa esa cámara? Beso a mami. No lo molesto más, vaya. Beso a mami. Mira, mami.
How often do you guys talk to her every day?
Oh my God.
Like, if you had to estimate.
24/7.
Like... I'll show you how many missed calls I get from her a day. Like, missed video call, missed video call, missed video call, missed video call. And she does not stop calling. See?
Was that today?
No, that's like, she called at 9:52, 9:50, last night, 9:52, 9:53, 9:58, 9:58, 9:58. And then today she called at 2:57, 3:06, and 3:18.
Porque entonces mami se va a sentir triste y ahí sí se va a sentir peor, mami, okay?
Sí, mami.
Ya sabe, usted va a ser presidente de ese país, yo ya se lo he dicho.
¿Un presidente? No, no mi estilo.
¿Sí? No, créalo.
No, no va a ser presidente. Demasiado trabajo y demasiados papeles.
No, pues por eso es que quiero que estudie. Se prepare.
A ser presidente, no.
What are you guys talking about?
Being president, I'm not going to be no president. That's scary. Para ser un presidente.
Your mom's saying she wants you to be president?
Yeah, she wants me to aim towards the goal of being a president.
Of Honduras or America?
Of the U.S.
So often when we were around the house with the family, it was kind of like Adalia was floating there, like her virtual spirit was there. They would call her and they would leave the phone out and they would just have her following around while they're playing video games or talking or eating dinner. They'd have her there, like literally on their computer screen or holding up their phone.
I love you.
I love you too, Ma.
Okay, bye, I love you.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
I love you.
I love you too, bye. But yeah.
Are you embarrassed to kiss your mom?
No, I'm not. Well, like sometimes.
So like normally, if you're a teenager, you can just be annoyed with your mom, slam the door and walk away. Do you feel guilty about getting annoyed with her?
Yeah, sometimes I feel like straight asshole. Like when I don't want to talk to her, I feel bad because it's kind of like fucked up. Like she's not here, and then we're being she wants to talk to us, and we're still being assholes. But like sometimes, like I just grab the phone and I talk to her because I feel like her heart like hurts like when we don't talk to her. So it's like I feel bad, but sometimes like. She calls too much. Well, like, she doesn't call too much, but, like, well, like, she does at the same time.
It's almost like you've become sort of like a parent in a way to her.
Yeah. So, like, I don't know how to explain it. After a while, like, yeah.
Like, you guys kind of take care of her.
Yeah. Well, I try to send her money as much as I can. Yeah, I try.
So when we met Andy and Arnold, they had started working in an arena, cleaning up after, like, monster truck rallies. They're high school kids, but they really felt they had to work after their mom was sent back. And they do this on the weekends, and sometimes they do it after school, which their mom does not love. And they also spend a ridiculous amount of time playing video games. They're really, really into video games. Like, that seems to be a primary sub-occupation.
Yeah, Andy's got his laptop out, and then Arnold's got Adalia on the phone, and you know, they're sort of not paying attention to anything because they're just, like, looking at the game.
Question, do you guys have homework?
Yeah, but we do it, like, later.
Okay. I do it during school.
Okay, I hope we're not keeping you from your homework.
No, that's fine. We usually do it later.
Okay. Like, do you stay up late?
Yeah.
He does, I don't, because I do it at
school.
I'm
a complete vampire. Like, if you were to fire right now,
so it was after 11 p.m. when we left their house, but they were still playing video games.
Oh no, you're gonna think you're doing. No.
Are you gonna do it?
Hey. How are you doing?
Good.
Should we whisper?
No. They should wake up by now.
Okay.
Andy!
We came back to the apartment around 6:30 in the morning, which is when they get ready for school. They were running around, you know, getting showered and dressed and ready. And their dad had already left for work at 4 in the morning. So they were kind of getting ready on their own.
How was that?
Dinara was just telling me, what time did you go to bed last night?
1 o'clock in the morning.
And what time did you wake up?
5.
So that's 4 hours of sleep.
Yep.
Whoa. So you barely slept last night. You slept 4 hours?
It was worth it, though. The show's great.
So you just stayed up because you wanted to watch your TV show?
Yep. I finished the first season, 1, 2, 3.
What? But how do you think, what do you think your mom would think?
She'd probably, like, take everything away from me.
Your TV and stuff? Did you tell her when you talked to her on the phone this morning?
No.
Is that your bus?
No, my bus comes at 7.
You know it's about 7, right?
6:53, Arnold. It's not 7 yet.
Oh, my gosh.
And is anything else different for you about your morning routine without your mom?
Yeah, usually we eat, and then, like, it makes my day better. But since I don't eat, like, I don't know, I'm grumpy in the mornings.
Yeah. So you've become more grumpy without having breakfast. Yeah.
So, like, because usually I just eat and eat and eat in the morning.
Yeah. But now you don't?
No.
What do you do instead?
I just sleep. I don't know.
Do you get hungry at school?
Yeah. I don't eat the breakfast there because it's nasty. It's like jail food.
Like jail food? Like what kind of things?
It's like they give us like meat, but it's like you could taste how frozen it is. Yeah. And then
Like, I don't know if you know the difference between fresh meat and frozen meat. It has a big difference, and the meat tastes just straight frozen, and it's gross.
And did your mom make frozen meat or fresh meat?
Fresh.
So your mom would make... What else does she make for breakfast?
She used to make us omelets with cheese in them and everything, just like bagels. She used to like... When she used to do the bagels for us, she used to like toast them and then wake us up and say, eat, come and eat. And then if we didn't eat, she'd get mad.
Yeah. So you're not used to going to school hungry?
No.
Andy's 16 years old, so his big concerns before his mom was deported were things like girls and football. And he's all about the Snapchat. He's really into that from the moment he wakes up in the morning to the moment he goes to bed. And he's very charming and... You can tell that he's a very fun kid and a very confident kid, but you can also tell that the situation since his mom's deportation is just taking a really big toll on him.
He feels like he's got pressures from both sides, right? There's like the normal kid pressures of just trying to exist in high school and make it through the day and have friends and do well. And then there's also this added layer that's been imposed on him where he has to step up and become like a third parent for this family.
And do you feel like it's a lot of responsibility making sure everybody gets out of the house and your sister and your brother are out?
Because sometimes when my sister doesn't want to go to school, she grabs her pillow and her blanket and she falls asleep in her closet.
Really? And yes. What do you do then?
Well, like, so I don't know she's there, but like I know all her little tricks now. And so every time I leave, I check the closets.
Okay, because that's kind of one of her tricks when she doesn't want to go to school.
Yeah, her and my brother, they just hide in the closet because they know I'll make them go to school.
And is that a more recent thing, or have they always been hiding in the closet?
It's a recent thing they've been doing. I don't know why.
Since your mom left?
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like maybe your sister has gotten really not into going to school since your mom left?
Yeah, she doesn't want to go to school at all or anything.
And why do you think that is?
Because, like, I feel like I know she's, like, hard-headed, and she doesn't want to take the fact that my mom's not here. And she's, like, I don't know, she's just stressed about it, and then she worries too much. About what would happen to my mom or what's happening to my mom and stuff like that.
Like she worries about her safety and stuff?
Yeah, because she knows it's dangerous out there. Yeah,
that makes sense.
When it comes to his dad, it's really clear that Andy and he have a good relationship. His dad really cares about and is proud of Andy and all the kids in the house. And Andy clearly feels the same way about his dad. But it's clear that it's also just hard for him to be a kid doing all the regular kid stuff and be contributing financially by working at the monster truck rallies and be translating for his dad at doctor's appointments. I mean, all of that, I think it creates some very genuine pressure.
Yeah, like sometimes it gets annoying because my dad is like, oh, can you do this? Can you do that? Can you pay the bill? Can you come home? Can you do that? So basically, like, I have to do everything. I have to pay the bills, send the checks, write the checks, mail the checks.
Do you think he's lonely?
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like he just locks himself in his room and listens to music all day. And, like, sometimes he just falls asleep or, like, sometimes he doesn't even cook because he feels like, I don't know, I feel like he feels stressed out about my mom a lot. Yeah.
Have you noticed things that he, how do you notice when he's missing your mom?
He locks himself in his room and then, like, just listens to sad music, like sad Spanish music.
That's 16-year-old Andy talking about his father with Sarah Stillman and Micah Hauser. Our story is called Parenting While Deported, and it continues in a moment. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're hearing the story of a family, a working-class family, living in New England. In 2017, their mother, Idalia, was arrested in a traffic violation, and she was turned over to immigration officers, who then quickly sent her to Honduras after she'd been living in the United States for nearly two decades. Idalia is trying to stay an active part of her family's life while living with relatives in Honduras. She's constantly on video calls with her family. And the three kids leave her image up on their phones as they make breakfast or go about their lives. Their father is in charge, but he's afraid of deportation himself. And it seems to have fallen to the middle child, Andy, a high school football player, to try to hold absolutely everything together. His two siblings, his anxious father, and his heartbroken mother. Sarah Stillman and Micah Hauser have been reporting on the family throughout the year.
A few months after we visited, Andy called me late one night, was sort of bummed out, and said that he'd actually been suspended from school for getting into a fight. When I asked him what happened, he said that his brother, Arnold Jr., was being bullied, actually. And even though Andy is younger than Arnold Jr., I think he sort of was the one who had to step up to defend him.
I mean, I was, like, a little aggravated because I know Arnold's been going through it. Like, it's hit him the most.
When you say it hit him the most, what do you mean by it?
Like, when my mom got deported, it affected him more than all of us. First thing was that we started noticing in my sister at first, and then him after.
How did you notice it?
Because I was just looking at him, and, like, every time we talked to my mom, like, he would, like, I don't, like, feel down. I was like, oh, I miss her so much. I miss her. I can't wait till I become a citizen so I can try to, like, bring her here. And then he's like, he just cries. I can, like, at night he cries.
Wow.
Because all I hear is, and he doesn't have allergies or anything, so all I hear is like that. And then he goes,
what do you say?
And then I know I don't say anything because I feel like he's going to feel embarrassed if I ask him, yo, why are you crying?
So at that point, it had been almost a year since Adelia was deported. And from talking with them, it was pretty clear that no one in the house was getting a decent night's sleep. And you could really feel the heaviness of it. It definitely seemed like things in the household had taken a turn for the worse. And when we last spoke, you mentioned that maybe your grades had been falling a little bit since your mom was arrested and deported. How's that going in terms of school and grades and all of that?
I haven't been to school in a while.
Okay.
Because I didn't drop out, but I sort of, like, took a break, and I'm like, no, I need to work to help my mom. And I've been working in construction a lot for the past month.
What was it that, how did you convince them to let you not come after the suspension was over?
Yeah, they think I'm in Honduras.
What do you think your mom would say? Does she know that you have this job?
Yeah, she was pissed.
What did she say?
Your education comes before anything. If I was down there, you guys wouldn't be working at all.
That's what she says?
Yeah.
And what do you say back?
And then I'm like, you helped me enough, and now it's my time to help you.
Have you saved up a lot of money?
Yeah.
How does that feel?
It feels good because knowing that I have enough, like, money to feed my mom and, like, fill up her fridge.
And you had told me that she found a job down in Honduras too, right?
Yeah, she works as a bartender.
And has she been liking it?
I mean, it's something, she says. I only make $20 a week.
And remind me, how much are you making at this construction job?
$24 an hour.
Wow. So you make more in an hour than your mom makes in a week.
Yeah. And I work 10, 12 hours.
So, Andy, has this changed your idea of sort of like what it means to be a young person in America?
Yeah, it's like, back then I would have never seen myself doing this.
Doing what?
Like working my ass off, and I would have never saw my mom in Honduras because I thought America was like a place that dreamers want to come. Like people dream to come here, but not anymore.
What did you see yourself doing?
Like, I saw myself, like, when I was a little kid, I was like, oh, I want to be a police officer. Oh, I want to be this. I don't know, but, like, now I'm just kind of like, oh, I don't want to be a police officer. I don't want to be anything that has to do with the law. At one point, I was thinking of becoming a border patrol agent.
Oh, wow.
So I can't bring my mom over the border.
Sneaky move.
Yeah.
Hola.
Hola.
¿Sí?
¿Cómo está, Iradia?
Hola. Bien, gracias.
Estamos aquí con Maika y una amiga se llama Aileen.
Hola, soy Aileen.
Adalia, do you feel like they're playing too many video games?
Oh, sí, bastante.
Oh, yes.
I
call them and I tell them to sleep. I go online and I see that they're connected and I say, why aren't you asleep? And they say that they have insomnia. And honestly, they've been using medicine to sleep. I don't know how to control this, how to help them.
Do you feel, Adalia, like you're getting the full story of what's happening at home? I
hope so. I hope that they're not ignoring anything that's happening. I hope that they're telling me everything as it's happening. I hope that it's complete. They're not hiding anything from me. Because imagine how I feel. Sometimes I can cry from feeling so that I have my hands tied together.
You mentioned something about the medicine they've been taking. Can you tell us more about that? And I wonder if it's scary to feel like you can't control that kind of thing as their mom.
Yes, it scares me because I even didn't really know it first. And sometimes, you know, I suggest to them that, you know, maybe they don't need the medicine. Maybe, you know, they can just control the things that they're doing, that they shouldn't watch TV. They shouldn't, you know, control their life a little bit more.
Later we learn that the kids have been taking melatonin. And Adalia and to an extent Arnold Sr. are both sort of grappling with this lack of control over how their kids are coping with this incredibly stressful situation and these bits of information that maybe in an earlier iteration of the family before Adalia's deportation would have been shared out in the open, and now there's really no one sort of watching over to make sure that everyone is on the same page. And Arnold Sr. is, by all accounts, a great dad. He's there, but he's working a lot to support the family. And on top of that, he's got his own deportation case to contend with. So it's really fallen on the kids to take care of themselves.
Back when we went to see the kids, they called their mom in Honduras, and we got to have a little tour of her home there by video chat.
There goes a guy on a little motorcycle.
A hammock.
Yeah, she's shown us this neighborhood. There's a dirt road and a patio that's gated in, some white wicker furniture, which I guess is where she sits to talk to the kids.
Pues vivimos humildemente, dile, pero pues un día pues ustedes van a venir aquí, voy a estar muy feliz. Ahora no.
She said that she's not happy because we're not there, but when we come, she's going to be very happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you going to go together this summer?
Yeah.
Okay. So for all three of the kids, being away from their mom was just getting unbearable by a certain point, and they really started to dream about going down to Honduras to be with her. And since Andy and Dayanara are U.S. citizens, they really started to flesh out that dream, what it would be like to go spend time with their mom down in Honduras, to think about enrolling in school, going to the park with her, just spending their days with their mom again. And finally, this past summer, they decided to get online, buy a ticket, and make the trip to be with their mom. And there was some question about whether or not they would ever come back.
Did she pick you guys up at the airport?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did she bring a sign or something?
Yes, she did.
Yeah, she made a sign.
What did the sign say?
Welcome to Honduras, Dayanara and Andy.
Yeah.
How did you feel when you saw the sign?
I was like, oh, I already knew it was coming since I landed.
She's
like,
one of the crazy moms like that goes all out.
I was like, watch mom hold the sign with pictures on it. And I was like, oh my God.
Were you embarrassed or was
no,
it cool?
I just knew it was coming. So I was like, see, I told you to my sister.
Did she sing you any songs?
No. Oh God, no.
No.
Okay, what was it like to be without your dad?
Relieving. My mom barely made us clean.
Did you feel like she was spoiling you?
Yeah, way too much. I don't know, she would just like, we would wake up and she would have like waffles or pancakes ready for us. And then the house already clean, everything like I'd feel bad, but like she'd have everything already done that we had to do.
That's helpful.
Yeah. And
anything else that she did special for you?
She let us. She let me drive wherever I wanted to.
She let me drive too, but she was in the car.
But she didn't trust my sister as much as she did.
Do you guys have a driver's license?
No.
Critical fact. How did you feel about driving? Did you like it?
I felt good. I was like, yo, I was so
nice.
Happy.
I wanted to speed.
Okay, you got some perks then from Honduras.
Nice.
I met some girls over there.
Of course you did.
Yeah, I met this girl. I don't know, we became close. And then she's like, I started going to her house and then we started going out to eat and stuff like that.
Wow. Where did you meet her?
I met her at church.
Okay, that's reputable.
Yeah, quite wholesome.
Yeah, my cousins took me and that's where I met her.
Did you tell, are other girls back in the U.S. jealous about that?
Oh, definitely. Like, I posted it on Instagram and then everybody was like, what? You got a girlfriend in Honduras now?
Okay.
Yeah, and then the girls over here were kind of jelly.
So if you were trying to describe Honduras to your friends, like, what would you say?
It's hot. The mosquitoes will eat you. But it's really beautiful. It's like, I don't know, the people are really like friendly. Well, some of them.
And some of the men, older men, are disgusting. Like when they see a young lady.
They're perverts.
Yes.
Oh, really? Like, what's that like?
They make a sound.
Type of sound?
They go like, like that to call you, or they go like that and they go behind you or they talk to you and they'll call you like mommy and stuff like that.
Oh, how did you feel about that, Dayanara?
Disgusted.
My sister thinks it's America. She told some guy she was going to call the cops on him.
Oh, really? How did that go?
And that guy's like, what the hell? I was like, yo, this is not America. The cops will not do anything here.
But in terms of the security stuff, did you feel safe walking down the street or walking around in the city?
No.
I did. I didn't really care.
I didn't really know people, so no.
But my mom, she really wanted me to cut my hair, all of it, because only the gang members have man buns like this.
And did she have any other things she wanted you to do like that for security?
She wanted me not to wear pants, not to wear too expensive shoes. She didn't let me wear nothing, basically nothing. I had to go out like with plain clothes. Like over here, I like putting like a bandana on. Over there, you can't do that. Because they'll think you're in a gang.
And did you hear about that kind of thing when you were down there? Like anybody getting killed or stuff like that?
The only thing we heard about, one of our cousins got killed. But he wasn't in good stuff. He was in the 18th Street gang.
Okay.
And then people from the MS-13 killed him.
Was the life, was it harder than you imagined it would be? Or was it about the same?
It's hard.
Because did it change your sense, Dayanara, that you would ever want to live there full time? Because I remember you saying maybe you would think about moving down there to be with your mom.
It definitely. I wanted to leave like so bad.
So you don't think you would ever live there?
No.
Okay. The kids had this very romantic idea of staying down in Honduras, getting to be with their mom and having all these fun times and maybe moving there. But it was pretty clear by the time we spoke when they were back that reality had set in. And their dad had made it clear that he needed them back before school started. They had intended to spend another 2 months down there, come back to school way late. And their dad didn't want them to fall behind. So he moved the flight back and they got home and got ready for school.
Yeah, so now it's sort of back to how it was before the visit, you know, talking to Adalia on video calls multiple times a day. Andy's back on his grind. He's working a landscaping job so he can keep earning money to send his mom. And he's also going to football practice twice a day and just sort of getting geared up for the school year.
And it seems like the reality is really setting in that the family is just going to be separated and have to live their distant lives unless Adalia can find some way to come back, which is both incredibly dangerous to make that journey. And also, if she does it unauthorized, it's a felony.
One day, I'm going to be there. And not right now, I can't go legally, but maybe I'll go.
Maybe I'll go anyways.
Do you have plans to try to come back?
I you know, for my part, if I can go, I'm going. Just like that. I'm trying first through a legal way, and we'll see. I'm putting my faith in God. But if I have to, those are my plans. I'm coming back any way I can.
And the trip back to the U.S. would be really dangerous, right? Are you worried about that, crossing over the border and what could happen?
Yeah, that worries me a lot. And that's why I'm afraid to do it, that something could happen to me, that I could die. I'm afraid to die. Sometimes in order to, you know, get over this fear, I think about maybe being able to see my kids again, being able to hug them. And that gives me the strength to try. But I still feel this fear that I could die.
So if Adalia does try to come back, it's certainly one of the most dangerous journeys in the world, one on which the majority of women are said to face sexual assault or other forms of persecution. And even if she does get here, the family knows that they just won't feel safe anymore, living even under the same roof in New England, just driving to work, going to the grocery store. All of those daily things now feel laced with peril. And so they've decided that if Adalia makes it back, that they're going to move to New York or move to New Jersey or to some place where they won't be as easily found and targeted by immigration enforcement.
In many ways, that impulse to move speaks to the collateral damage that is felt by families all over the country as a result of the Trump immigration enforcement regime, this sort of these tentacles of fear that pervade daily life when you have a parent who has been separated or maybe another undocumented parent who has yet to be separated, but that threat is constantly looming.
Yeah, I think when we first met this family more than a year ago, I still thought of deportations as a moment in time, a discrete moment when a family was pulled apart. And following them over all this time, for me, what has really stood out is realizing that it's also this slow drip, drip, drip of what it means every day to wake up without your mom, to have her not there when you're brushing your teeth at the end of the night, and the toll that long-term separation takes. That, to me, is an invisible part of the family separation story.
I get mad when, like, when my friends disrespect their moms and they're like, no, like, F you, mom, why don't you do it yourself? And I was like, dude, don't talk to your mom like that. Your mom's the one thing that you're gonna love and miss forever. And then they're like, oh, she's annoying, this and that. I was like, trust me. And then they're like, oh, what do you know about stuff like that? I'm like, a lot, just trust me. And then, like, I tried to, like, tell them that it's not cool, it doesn't look cool on him or anything. Yeah.
So you feel like some of your friends don't even have gratitude for the fact that their moms actually are around?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of upsetting, but it's life.
Staff writer Sarah Stillman, reporting with Micah Hauser of The New Yorker. And you can find everything Sarah's written for us on immigration and other subjects at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every week in our podcast, Politics and More, Dorothy Wickenden interviews one of our writers about the biggest and most consequential events in the nation. She's just talked with Washington correspondent Susan Glasser about what was, even by the standards of the Trump White House, a remarkable week, from the release of a Bob Woodward bombshell to the anonymous op-ed from within the administration.
In many ways, it seems to be as much about ego and vanity as patriotism and principle. That being said, you know, you don't get to pick and choose your resistance. You have people
not exclusively on the left, who are just made absolutely furious by people like Jeff Flake or these anonymous inside the administration folks who speak out with words against Trump but don't take action. On the other hand, the lesson of leaders who are brought down is that they need people on the inside to turn on them. And this is an indicator of that occurring. And my guess is that it's actually going to become more and more an issue in our politics.
That's Politics and More from The New Yorker. You can find it at newyorker.com/podcasts. Kwame Anthony Appiah has spent much of his professional life trying to answer very simple questions like, who am I? What are you? What's the right thing to do? He's a professor of philosophy and law at New York University and a leading thinker on identity. But I think it's important to note with Appiah, he's not only a man of the academy, he writes the Ethicist column in the New York Times Magazine, answering readers' questions on matters of parenting and dating and so on. Recently, somebody asked him, I'm running for re-election. How honest do I have to be? In his new book, The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity, Appiah argues something that's just a little bit old-fashioned and not necessarily popular on the left, not with everyone. He says that identities of race, gender, culture, country can work against human solidarity and sometimes get in the way of solving our problems. And with the world as globalized as it is, whether you like it or not, he says that we have to change some of our old ways of thinking about who we are and how we relate to others. I've known Anthony Appiah for a long time, and we sat down recently to talk. Anthony, you've written this wonderful book about identity that began as a series of lectures, and I thought we'd start with your own identity and your parents. Your parents were perhaps one of the most famous marriages in 20th century Britain and Ghana. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, my father was in London as a law student for an astonishingly long time because most of what he was doing wasn't law but anti-colonial agitation. He used to go to Hyde Park Corner to speak against the British, even during the war. So he was there and he met my mother. And my mother was working for an organization called Racial Harmony, which looked after colonial students. And that's how they met.
And your father was an important political figure in Ghana.
Yes. So he was, among other things, at that point, he was the unofficial representative of Kwame Nkrumah, who was going to be the first president of Ghana. And he was also very much involved in creation of the first opposition party to Nkrumah, which grew out of the Asante elite to which he belonged. His father was the brother-in-law and the secretary of the King of Ashanti, and later on, my uncle Matthew became the next king of Asante, so he was very much connected with sort of old royalty in Kumasi, where we grew up. And my mother's family was also, you know, her father was Chancellor of the Exchequer, leader of the House of Commons. Her grandfather was the first Labour leader of the House of Lords. And there were lots of cousins who were
so kind of
distinguished
left,
people.
A left-leaning aristocratic elite.
Yes.
And they get married, and the effect in Britain and in Ghana is what? What is the reaction?
You have to remember that I wasn't there. Our sense of it came from our parents who kept these newspaper scrapbooks of the coverage. And, you know, it went from the most extreme coverage was in South Africa and places like that, and actually some American regional newspapers in the South, through, you know, Ebony Magazine, which thought this was kind of cool. to speeches in the South African Parliament about what was going to happen to Britain if they allowed the daughters of cabinet ministers to marry what they called blanket natives. I assume that means natives who wear blankets. And my mother got horrible letters, mostly from white women around the empire and the world, telling her that she was letting the side down.
So, Anthony, coming from this background, how does this shape identity, which is the subject of the book, your own identity, how you view it, or how you don't view it? Its multiplicity, its fluidity. You recently wrote an article about the phenomenon of people beginning their sentences or testimonies speaking as a woman, speaking as a black woman, Jewish man, whatever.
Because the combination of identities that I have is a bit unusual. I mean, if I'm asked to say what I am, quickly, I suppose I would say I'm an American citizen of Anglo-Ghanaian ancestry who's gay. I mean, those are the things. I would have mentioned religion if I had one, but I don't.
So what frustrates you when you hear identity discussed in the university, in the workplace, and in the political realm?
I think the main thing that worries me is that even people who people think of as not very complicated, in fact, have quite complicated identities. I mean, I've said that I come to this the way I do because there's an obvious sense in which my identity is in some way more complicated than some people's. But, you know, if we talk about...
But the book suggests that everybody is, to some extent, yes, much more complicated,
yes,
than they let on.
And I think that's right. So, for example, we currently, for obvious reasons, do a great deal of talking about something we call the white working class. But their whiteness, such as it is not the same as the whiteness of everybody else. It's not the same as the president's whiteness. And some of them are Baptists and some of them are not. And that might matter a great deal to them. Some are born again, some are not. These other dimensions of their identity are, for many, many practical purposes, more important to them than their white identity because they're not interacting much of the time with people who aren't white. So race is, for a lot of the time, not super important. So if you're trying to make a republic, we need to think about our fellow citizens as it were as they are. And what they are is complicated, not simple, and reducing them to anything, including a political identity, reducing them to Republican, Democrat, independent, reducing them to white, reducing them to working class, and so on, just will get you in a mess. That's one thing. Another thing is if we're going to do things about the economics, I think history suggests that we're going to need identities to do it. The great successes that created the modern welfare state occurred because starting in Britain in the early 19th century, the working class got organized as a class. They made labor unions. They had working men's associations. When Frederick Douglass went to England, he talked to working men's associations. So you couldn't do that unless you got – it wasn't just that you had to think of the working classes as having interests in common. You had to think of them as a kind of person, and they then had to think of themselves that way in order to get mobilized. Now, they were not just working class any more than anybody was just middle or upper class. But it was an important identity to mobilize around. So if we want to do – and the last chapter of my book urges us – that we do need to do something about class, the first thing we need to do is to recognize it as a form of identity. So if you think, as I do, that there are serious problems of economic inequality in this country that won't be dealt with unless we think about class, then you don't want to substitute identity politics for not identity politics. You want to reshape identity politics to make it more productive, to focus on things that you need to focus on and not to become overinvested in just one or two kinds of identities.
What role did tribalism, nativism, and questions of identity play in a political drama in which the very same country elected Barack Obama and then 8 years later elected Donald Trump? We'll take the Russian part out of it and all the various shenanigans out of it, but tens of millions of people did vote for Donald Trump.
Yes. Well, because of the way our electoral system works, we should begin by recording that more people didn't vote for Donald Trump in the United States than did. And those people were presumably people who thought that mostly thought that the right thing had been done in electing Barack Obama and that they were hoping to continue his legacy. You have to remember that in the United States, most people vote the way they do because it's the way they've always voted. So a significant number of people will have voted for Donald Trump just because he was the person produced by the Republican process. And the fact that they continue to support him, even though you can see that he's doing things that the Republican Party used to be against, like cozying up to Russia, starting trade wars and increasing tariffs. And they now have mostly been persuaded that, well, if that's what my party's in favor of, I'm in favor of it. In other words, what's happened is that a particular person has taken over the leadership of a particular identity group, namely people who identify as Republicans. And in the few places where the shifts happened that explain why he got the votes in the Electoral College that he did, those shifts occurred in people who did indeed make a change of mind. And I think they made the change of mind, some of them, because of a real fact. The fact is that our country is moving away from being a white man's country, and both the white and the man in there are important, to being what some of us have always hoped it would be, which is an American country in which you could be a happy non-white person and a happy woman and a happy, for that matter, gay, lesbian, transgender person, and participate on roughly equal terms in the life of the republic. And, you know, if you start out with this precious possession of a privileged identity, it's not nice for you. It's hard. I understand that there's a challenge here.
To see it eroded.
To see it eroded.
Some time ago, Claudia Rankine was here. And as you know, among other things, she talks a great deal about microaggressions, which is not her invention. I think it had earlier roots in academic discourse. You are very wary of talking about that in a highly judgmental way. In fact, wearing your other hat as the New York Times ethicist, not long ago you had a letter from a woman, somebody in a Filipino family, and there was a kind of family drama about in-laws talking insensitively about the ability to tell one Asian from another, as it were. And you said, you know, you might start by recognizing that their attitudes, meaning these relatives who were doing the offending, you might start by recognizing that their attitudes most likely reflect ignorance rather than malice, and by cutting them some slack.
I think that one reason for wanting to cut people slack is that maybe my deepest philosophical conviction is that it's hard to get things right. Knowledge is a difficult achievement for us. So is leading a good life. And yes, people will screw up. That's a feature of our nature and our situation. The helpful thing to do when people screw up is to try and sort of help them pick themselves up and dust themselves off and start off in a better direction, not to stigmatize them and push them down. Now, I'm perfectly happy to criticize people who behave badly, but I think also it's important to understand them. And here's one reason why it's important to understand them. If you understand what it is about a person and her circumstances that makes her do something, you might be able to change her circumstances in a way that makes her not want to do that anymore.
Anthony, finally, you've packed a lot into a relatively short book, and one of the things is a kind of large cultural project that you're advocating. You're asking readers to feel a sense of ownership over universal values, and you write this: a culture of liberty, tolerance, and rational inquiry, that would be a good idea. But these values represent choices to make, not tracks laid down by a Western destiny, unquote. Do you worry that we've become complacent about understanding and upholding these values?
Yes, I think that some of the responsibility for that comes from movements within the academies. It isn't all just the result of bad behavior on the part of a few people in one party. I think it's hard to figure out sometimes what the right answer is in moral context, but I believe there is one. And if there is one, then it doesn't matter whether you're Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, or atheist. That's the answer. We're not trying to develop a Muslim view about global warming and a Western view about that. Better just to say, let's try and figure out what's going on with global warming. And that, in that sense, I'm a creature of the Enlightenment. I really do believe in the beautiful and the good and the true.
Are you feeling lonely these days in that?
I'm feeling that people have come to see that losing track of that idea was a big loss. So I'm feeling a temptation, at least, on the part of many people to come back to that. The sort of basic thought that we'll be able to run the world much better if we agree that what we're trying to do is to make sense of it together.
Anthony Appiah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kwame Anthony Appiah. His book, The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity, was just published. And you can read his advice on people's ethical dilemmas every week in the New York Times' Ethicist column. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll join us again next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Cal Aaliyah, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.